It's Monday, July 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, perceptions of the United States are changing in Iran as the U.S. Congress prepares to consider the nuclear agreement with that nation.
There's a war here, and it's going to not get better. It's going to get worse before it does get better. And America is going to fight it, and America will win in the long run.
A sense of safety shaken following another U.S. shooting. Also ahead, a woman will be the next president of Taiwan. When you have just 50 cents, you must be bankrupt. It's all coming up on today's International Edition.
Debt to America is definitely on a decline.
An outspoken Tehran University academician says that anti-American ideology under the slogan Death to America is at a dead end in Iran. Political science professor Sadiq Zibel Kalam said in an exclusive interview with the VOA Central News Division that due to changes that have occurred in Iran in recent years, we are observing the sunset of Death to America.
Death to America is definitely on a decline. And I believe that the Vienna agreement, the nuclear agreement between Iran and United States, virtually might be referred to in the Iranian Islamic history as a turning point. Which marks the end of the beginning of the end of anti-Americanism.
The professor says the most educated Iranians were eager to see the nuclear agreement go through and are no longer supporting, calling, and shouting death to America. But will it be death to the Iran nuclear deal at the hands of the U.S. Congress? A vote will be coming soon. Our Senate correspondent Michael Bowman is here now. Michael, President Obama hasn't seemed to have received the positive support that he was hoping to get from Congress.
Well, Jim, I assume that the Obama administration would very much have liked in the days after this accord was announced for there to be an upswing in terms of how Congress views this. I would say that the reverse has occurred. Republicans seem to be digging in deeper as far as their opposition to this and becoming more and more adamant about it. And Democrats that the White House would have hoped would rally around this deal are being as circumspect today as they were the day that it was announced. There has been no groundswell of support for it coming from Capitol Hill, although the leader of House Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, did come out and endorse it. But she has been the exception. This coming week, the deal goes before the United Nations, where presumably the Security Council could approve this. And that is causing further consternation and further heartburn up on Capitol Hill. Congress passed a bill, and Obama signed it into law, saying that Congress would have 60 days to review and vote on this deal. And the complaints coming from Republicans is that you could have the deal already approved by the United Nations and setting in motion a process by which sanctions are relaxed before Congress has a chance to weigh in on this.
And presumably the Republicans are against it mostly because of political reasons. They're gearing up for a presidential campaign. They would like to discredit President Obama. They weren't too thrilled with him to begin with.
All of this is true, although I suspect that's true, Jim. Although to a man or woman, Republicans will tell you that their opposition to this is grounded in America's best interests and national security and distrust over Iran. But there is a political reality here, and we are gearing up for next year's presidential contest. And the way that it looks right now is that there will be votes in Congress disapproving the deal. President Obama will veto that disapproval. And then the question becomes, will enough Democrats hold on to save it and vote against an override of that veto, in which case the deal survives. And if that happens, you will face the prospect of President Obama's two biggest accomplishments on the domestic realm and in foreign affairs, the Affordable Care Act on the domestic front and this Iran deal as far as global matters go, coming into being solely as Democratic Party entities, something that only Democratic support. Lawmakers will be home in their districts, in their home states, talking to constituents. And this gives them extra time to do that, the extra 30 days. And one could see that if the American people weigh in on this decisively one way or another, in other words, this is a good deal, something we should pursue, or this is horrible. If the American people weigh in decisively on this, I think that could have a real impact when Congress comes back in September and ultimately votes on this.
Well, as they say, all politics is local, and even when it comes to an Iran nuke deal, we're glad that locally in our studio we have our worldly man, Mike Bowman.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
And turning now to what's happening on the Twittersphere, we have International Edition's G. Abby Lee here in the studio to tell us what's the buzz on the Iran deal on social media. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. You're absolutely right, because all politics is local, even when it comes to an international agreement. And that's why part of the reason the White House and the Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei are tweeting from different views this weekend. The White House tweeted about 6 hours ago that if Iran violates this deal, the sanctions we imposed would snap back into place promptly. That's a quote from the U.S. President Barack Obama on the hashtag Iran deal. The White House is on Twitter at White House, and the president is at POTUS. That's POTUS. That tweet has been retweeted about 130 times and marked as a favorite more than 150 times.
Well, as we know, the White House is an active tweeter. Is that the main tweet out of the White House today?
Not really. There are a total of 7 tweets with hashtag Iran deal from the White House Sunday, and that was just one of them. So I'll say Iran is a main topic coming out of the White House today.
Well, that's a lot on just one topic. What about the Iranian side?
Well, Jim, as you know, the Supreme Leader is the most powerful figure in that country, not the elected president or the cabinet. So let's take a look at what he tweeted. Khamenei tweeted this Saturday that even with hashtag Iran deal, our policies toward U.S. arrogant system will see no change. U.S. policies in the region, meaning the Middle East, differ through 180 degrees from Iran's. So it's not entirely grammatically correct, but you can tell the gist of what he's trying to say. And that tweet has been retweeted almost 170 times and marked as a favorite more than 100 times. Khamenei is on Twitter at Khamenei_IR. That's KHAMENEI_IR.
Okay, so both accounts use the hashtag Iran deal. How popular was that?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because a social media analytics website, Topsy, shows that that hashtag was used more than 16,000 times in the last 24 hours. That's a pretty robust interest for a topic that's been trending for weeks now.
It sure is. Well, thank you for that analysis today, G. That was G. Abby Lee. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This is VOA's International Edition. We come to you every weekday from Studio 22 right here in our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Residents of Chattanooga, Tennessee, in the southern United States, are in mourning after a lone gunman there shot and killed four Marines and a sailor who died of his wounds on Saturday. Sharon Bain tells us how the attacks like this are eroding Americans' sense of safety.
Michael Dexter said he had nothing to give the ones who died, so he gave them a lullaby.
For some reason, this is a world that we live in, where in a weird, twisted way, we accept that there are lots of bullet holes in that glass.
As yet, no one knows why Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, a Kuwaiti-born naturalized American, on Thursday attacked two military facilities here. But some feel that the war the U.S. is fighting against terrorism has reached small-town America.
Say a silent prayer.
Jerry Lawhorn, a Vietnam War veteran, was defiant.
There's a war here, and it's going to not get better. It's going to get worse before it does get better. And America is going to fight it, and America will win in the long run.
Army veteran Deandra Pointer was in shock.
You think you're safe, but this war is spilled over into our communities, and none of us are safe, are we?
Fear is normal, says Chattanooga Police Chief Fred Fletcher.
There are a number of people in our community that feel in fear of their safety in the aftermath of this. I can tell you that the Chattanooga Police Department and I personally, as their chief of police, are committed to doing whatever we can to help everybody, regardless of their faith or regardless of their circumstances, be and feel safe.
The latest shooting has unnerved people here. Keith Sanford said the shooting is like the church shooting in South Carolina that left nine dead.
We had, the case in Charleston and the case here. One was a naturalized citizen, one was an American-born person, and to be, they're both terrorism.
We bless your name in the midst of all that we're going through.
Hundreds attended a multi-faith prayer service for those who died. Bassam Issa was one of them.
We feel so saddened about this heinous crime, and we condemn it or any violence in the world to the strongest.
For those grieving, the shooting was simply a tragedy they were struggling to understand.
Once blind.
Sharon Bain, VOA News, Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Voters in Taiwan next year are all but sure to elect a woman as their next president. The ruling Nationalist Party on Sunday picked Taiwan's deputy legislative speaker and a former teacher as their candidate, and she will be running against the chief opposition party's chairwoman. And that's coming up in the January election. Taiwan has never seen two female candidates run for the major parties or elected a woman as president. We hear more now from Ralph Jennings, who reports for VOA from Taipei.
The Taiwan ruling Nationalist Party's first female presidential nominee will compete in the January 2016 election with a woman picked earlier this year by the chief opposition party. The opposition Democratic Progressive Party candidate Tsai Ing-wen ran for the office in 2012, but against the man who is today's president, Ma Ying-jeou. She is running now against the deputy speaker of parliament, Hong Xiu-ju. Women have become heads of state in India and South Korea, among other Asian countries, but never in Taiwan. Philip Yang, spokesman for the Nationalist Candidates campaign, said Taiwan stands out already because two women are competing.
Not in other countries that both the opposition, major opposition and ruling parties candidates are both female. So this is probably making this campaign very interesting.
Nationalist nominee Hong is 67 years old and a former teacher. Her rival, Tsai, is 58 years old and a lawyer by training. She lost the 2012 presidential race by 6 percentage points. Political observers say Taiwanese voters can accept a female president because their democracy has matured since it began in the late 1980s, and women over 50 were traditionally regarded as capable clan leaders in the traditional Chinese culture that anchors Taiwan. A third of Taiwan's legislators are female, and women lead some of the island's top companies. As an indication that gender is a minor issue for voters, debate about the presidency has shifted toward one of Taiwan's thorniest dilemmas, which is its tense but recently cordial relationship with China. President Ma set aside political disputes with China in 2008 to open landmark dialogue that has led to a series of economic agreements. Hong advocates keeping up that dialogue on Beijing's condition that both sides view themselves as a single China, but with different ideas about what China means. Tsai also wants more dialogue, but rejects the One China basis for talks, making Beijing nervous. Ross Feingold, the Taipei-based senior advisor with American political risk manager DC International Advisory, says voters will consider each candidate's China policy as well as their views on economic issues.
Both candidates have been public figures for a considerable amount of time, so there's certainly things to look at in their past record or their positions on current issues that are enough to talk about without making gender an issue.
Many Taiwanese want a more cautious relationship with China, and opinion surveys show Tsai leading her rival about half a year ahead of the election. The winner will replace President Ma in May as he steps down due to term limits. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Rapper 50 Cent, or as we know, he says 50 Cent, has declared bankruptcy after a court ruled that he had to pay $5 million to a New York woman for releasing a sex tape without her permission. International Edition's David Byrd and Ray McDonald talked about the multimillionaire's case, which will go ahead despite his insolvency.
When your album is Get Rich or Die Trying, and you actually do get rich and don't die, to declare bankruptcy might seem a little strange. Ray, what is this with 50 Cent saying he's bankrupt or filing for Chapter 11 protection?
It was all a strategic maneuver, Dave. On July 13th, 50 Cent filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy just a few days after losing a lawsuit. He was ordered to pay a $5 million compensatory judgment after a woman sued him over a sex tape he posted featuring her a few years back.
Now, this woman is rapper Rick Ross's ex-girlfriend.
That's exactly right, and 50 is beefing with Rick Ross. So.
And so this is kind of like, okay, I'm going to shame you in public. And
jab you.
Okay, but the court ruled in the woman's favor that she was actually defamed or libeled, or not libeled, I guess that's print, but she was defamed by this videotape.
This is correct. Now, back in May, Forbes magazine estimated 50 Cent's net worth to be $155 million. I think it's important to note that the man is not out of money. In fact, he's making light of this entire situation. He posted an online photo of himself standing next to a tiny little smart car, saying, yeah, things are tough out here.
Well, now he wears Armani suits and Jimmy Choo shoes. He has like a Rolex on his arm.
He's doing promotion for his latest movie, Southpaw.
Right. And he also sold his vitamin water interest for $100 million. Now, he did have to pay out another judgment when somebody sued his headphone manufacturing company for copyright infringement or trademark infringement or something?
This is correct. And 50 makes the point that when you are successful, he says, I have a bullseye on my back. I'm an easy target. But this lawsuit has not played itself out yet. The $5 million judgment, as I said, is for compensatory damages. Punitive damages are still to be determined.
So he could be forced to pay this. I thought when you go into Chapter 11, that protects you from your creditors, so all these judgments against you and anybody you owe money to just disappear.
In a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, proof of insolvency is not required to file. It's more a reorganization of whatever assets you do have. How much does 50 have? At this point, we don't know, but we may find out.
All right. Now, if you want to send Ray a tweet, he is RayOnTheHits at Twitter.com. You can also hit him up on at VOA underscore music. And, of course, you can send us a tweet here at International Edition. We are at VOA underscore IE. And if you want to hit me up, I'm at David underscore DBird. And that's BYRD on Twitter.
There's much more on 50 Cent and a lot of other artists on our website at voanews.com. You can also check us out on Facebook at VOA Asia. And, of course, we're on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. You've been listening to International Edition. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman. And we thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As unusually warm ocean temperatures cover the North Pacific, Equatorial Pacific, and Western Atlantic Oceans, scientists of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, expect greater bleaching of corals of Northern Hemisphere reefs through October, potentially leading to the death of corals over a wide area and affecting the long-term supply of fish and shellfish. Coral bleaching occurs when corals are stressed by changes in environmental conditions, such as temperature, light, or nutrients. The coral expels the symbiotic algae living in its tissue, causing the tissue to turn white or pale. Without the algae, the coral loses its major source of food and is more susceptible to disease. Scientists note, however, that only high temperatures can cause bleaching over wide areas like those seen since 2014. Many healthy, resilient coral reefs can withstand bleaching as long as they have time to recover, said Mark Aiken, NOAA Coral Reef Watch coordinator. However, when you have repeated bleaching on a reef within a short period of time, it's very hard for the corals to recover and survive. This is even worse where corals are suffering from other environmental threats, like pollution or overfishing. Additionally, even if corals recover from the bleaching, they are more susceptible to disease. Once corals die, it usually takes decades for the reef to recover. But recovery is only possible if the reefs are undisturbed, which is extremely difficult to ensure. After corals die, reefs degrade, and the structures which corals build are eroded away, providing less shoreline protection and fewer habitats for fish and shellfish. The bleaching that started in June 2014 has been really bad for corals in the Western Pacific, Aiken said. We are worried that bleaching will spread to the Western Atlantic and again into Hawaii. Earlier this year, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch 4-month coral bleaching outlook accurately predicted coral bleaching in the South Pacific, including the Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea, Nauru, Fiji, and American Samoa. It also recently predicted the coral bleaching in the Indian Ocean. The United States, through agencies like NOAA and specific programs such as the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program and in cooperation with international partners, is helping protect the atmosphere and ocean on which life on Earth depends.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.